The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the April 25th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is a fighting rink. It looks like what they call ultimate fighting. It's got a cage around it. The opponents are China's Xi Jinping and our own Donald Trump. Xi is facing us. He is just ripped with muscles in his chest and neck. He's got a stern look on his face. Tattoo of a dragon on his chest. Mr. Trump has his back to us. His hair is tousled. He's looking a little less buff, let's say. He's got a big tattoo on his back that says MAGA. The headline is Ultimate Trade War. Will Trump's tariffs hurt the U.S. more than China? We've got a couple of stories related to that, but we're going to skip that main story and read the first one. Trump defies court over migrants' deportation. What happened? A potential constitutional crisis loomed this week as a federal judge accused the Trump administration of ignoring a Supreme Court order to pursue the release of an asylum seeker from a notoriously brutal El Salvador megaprison. In a unanimous ruling, the nation's highest court largely affirmed U.S. District Judge Paula Zinnis' order that it must facilitate El Salvador's return of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a 29-year-old Maryland father of three, sheet metal worker, and university student who was detained and deported without a hearing. Chief Justice John Roberts, however, gave Trump some wiggle room, saying that Zinnis must defer to Trump's authority in foreign affairs and could not dictate his dealings with El Salvador. In response, Attorney General Pam Bondi said facilitate meant only the U.S. would provide a plane if El Salvador chose to return him. After the Supreme Court's ruling, Zinnis scolded the White House for that interpretation, saying nothing has been done to bring Abrego Garcia back, and ordered a period of intense discovery in which administration officials would have to testify about their efforts to comply with her order. There will be no tolerance for gamesmanship, she warned. Another federal judge, James Boasberg, this week found probable cause to find the administration in criminal contempt for failing to obey his stay on other deportations to El Salvador under the 1798 Alien Enemies Act, giving officials until April 23rd to try to purge their contempt. In an Oval Office meeting with El Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele, Trump and his cabinet officials scoffed at the idea of seeking Abrego Garcia's return and insisted he was an illegal alien. Bukele called the suggestion of a transfer preposterous. Abrego Garcia was apprehended in March in front of his 5-year-old autistic son, accused of membership in the MS-13 gang, and sent to El Salvador's Massive Terrorism Confinement Center, or CECOT. In a court hearing, Trump administration officials later conceded it was an administrative error to deport Abrego Garcia. In 2019, an immigration judge had blocked his deportation to his native El Salvador and found that he had credible fear of persecution by violent gangs there. Trump, meanwhile, floated the idea of sending U.S. citizens convicted of crimes to El Salvador's prison. The homegrowns are next, he said. What the editorial said. The Supreme Court's ruling ought to have been the end of the matter, said the Chicago Tribune, but the Trump administration has since refused to comply, on the pretense it can't force El Salvador to send Abrego Garcia back. The U.S. is paying Bukele $6 million to imprison deported migrants for a year, and he would promptly return Abrego Garcia to these shores if Trump said to do so. Roberts offered Trump a chance to avoid a constitutional crisis, said the Wall Street Journal. But instead of quietly asking Bukele to return Abrego Garcia, Trump is essentially taunting the Supreme Court. Why is he risking so much over the fate of a single man? The president may be bloody-minded enough that he wants to show the judiciary who's boss. What the columnist said. Trump is clearly acting in bad faith, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. Although Abrego Garcia was illegally deported to El Salvador, he remains in the constructive custody of our federal government, which is simply paying Bukele to temporarily house him in prison. There appears to be no reason, other than his own stubbornness, that Trump could not immediately bring back Abrego Garcia for a hearing that respects his due process rights. Any claim to the contrary is laughable. One Trump official after another has claimed Abrego Garcia belongs to the MS-13 gang, said Greg Sargent in the New Republic. But the only evidence a detective provided in 2019 was conspicuously thin, that the migrant wrote a Chicago Bulls cap, wore a Chicago Bulls cap and hoodie, and was named as a gang member by a confidential informant. But that detective later pleaded guilty to divulging confidential information to a sex worker and was suspended. Meanwhile, Abrego Garcia was never charged with, let alone convicted of, any crime while holding a job and supporting his family. This is state terror, said Timothy Snyder in his Substack newsletter, and every American is vulnerable. The Constitution's bedrock principle is habeas corpus, the right not to be bodily detained without legal justification. But the Trump administration claims our dear leader is acting on a mandate from the people and cannot be restrained by law, due process, or court orders from sending people he deems dangerous to foreign concentration camps. That means that even if you're a citizen, the government can claim that you're a foreign terrorist and disappear you. If Trump wins his struggle with the court, said Noah Smith in No Opinion, then we do, in fact, live in a dictatorship. We can only hope he'll prove incompetent enough to botch this transition to authoritarianism. It's upon this thin thread that we must hang our hopes for democracy. Controversy of the week. Retribution. Trump calls for prosecution of critics. President Trump fired a warning shot from the edge of autocracy last week, said Tom Hartman in the New Republic. The U.S. moved much closer to becoming a police state when Trump signed executive memoranda directing Attorney General Pam Bondi to investigate public comments made by two former officials, Christopher Krebs, a former top cybersecurity official in the first Trump administration, who debunked baseless claims that the 2020 election was stolen, and Miles Taylor, a former Homeland Security official who wrote an anonymous newspaper column and book criticizing Trump. They're public servants whose only crime was speaking truth to power. But a vengeful Trump now wants them prosecuted to send a chilling message to current and future whistleblowers. Cross me, and you'll pay. Trump is no longer simply using the justice system to reward friends, as he did when he pardoned January 6 rioters this year, said Mona Shirin in The Bulwark. Ominously, he has targeted individuals he views as enemies. In Krebs' case, he has ordered the Justice Department to scour his tenure in government to find some form of misconduct. In the infamous words of Lavrinti Beria, Stalin's hatchet man, "Show me the man, and I will find the crime." Krebs and Taylor are minor characters from season one of The Trump Show, said Nick Cottagio in The Dispatch. So why target them? It signals there are no insignificant critics, and that if you cause this president any trouble, You should sleep less soundly at night. No one is safe. The ball is in Bondi's court, said Ellie Honig in New York. An ethical attorney general would not proceed without predication of a crime. But despite assurances during her Senate confirmation hearing that she would uphold the Justice Department's independence, Bondi has shown she's in the bag for Trump. Unlike her predecessor, Bill Barr, who ignored Trump's public pleas to arrest enemies, Bondi will vigorously investigate. And even if she can't bring charges or make them stick, Krebs and Taylor could face staggering legal fees, searches of their phones and computers, intrusive interviews of friends and colleagues, and damage to their careers. Trump broke a promise by sicking Bondi on Krebs and Taylor, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. He campaigned on ending lawfare, and in January signed an executive order squashing the weaponization of government. So much for that. Now he's doing precisely what Democrats did to him. The hypocrisy doesn't end there, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post. Trump says Taylor is guilty of treason, accusing him of exposing classified conversations. But after his first term, Trump was indicted for taking and resisting returning more than 100 classified documents and stashing them in a bathroom at Mar-a-Lago. The attacks on Krebs and Taylor ushers in phase two of the second Trump presidency, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. Phase one featured the Elon Musk-led purge of federal agencies. That was done in the name of cost-cutting. But the Department of Government Efficiency's work also reduces the number of longtime professionals who might stand in the way of Trump's retribution mission. To advance that mission, Trump fired career Justice Department attorneys who might object to political prosecutions, and punished and neutered law firms that have represented Trump's critics. Now in phase two, critics will taste his vengeance. For Trump, revenge isn't just a welcome adjunct to controlling the levels of government. It's the whole point of his second term. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for redesigning the pearly gates. After Vatican put God's architect, the modernist master Antoni Gaudi, on the path to sainthood. It was a good week for togetherness. After three female elephants at the San Diego Zoo Safari Park quickly formed a protective alert circle to protect two calves as the ground shook from a magnitude 5.2 earthquake. On sensing the tremors, the females immediately surrounded seven-year-old calves named Zul and Micaiah until the quake passed. And it was a good week for try again. After Rory McIlroy finally won the Masters to give him the last of the four majors in golf's Grand Slam, 11 years after he clinched his third. McIlroy, who lost a three-stroke lead on the final round of the Masters in 2011, called the victory the best day of my golfing life. It was a bad week for security after a whistleblower told Congress and CNN that DOGE staffers secretly used Starlink to export vast amounts of sensitive worker, union, and employer data from the records of the National Labor Relations Board. Russian hackers then logged into NLRB's computers using the right passwords, the whistleblower said. It's a bad week for air passengers after United Airlines said it had begun reducing the number of daily flights because the softer economic situation is creating softer demand for travel. Air travel from Canada and by U.S. government workers, the airline said, had noticeably declined. Finally, it was a bad week for credibility after President Trump's doctor reported that he's 6'3", weighs 224 pounds, and is in excellent health due to his active lifestyle. That makes Trump an inch taller and 16 pounds lighter than when he was booked in Manhattan in 2023 on 34 felony counts. And the briefing, China Shock 2.0. An overflow of Chinese goods is flooding the global market. Tariffs won't stop it. Why has China ramped up its exports? Domestic economic woes have made the world's largest exporter even more reliant on sending goods abroad. Aiming to offset a major real estate bust, Beijing has made an all-out effort to boost manufacturing in the country. China's trade surplus hit nearly $1 trillion last year, more than doubling since 2019. State-controlled banks dished out a cool $1.9 trillion to industrial borrowers over the past 4 years. And even by conservative estimates, China spent more on industrial subsidies than it did on national defense in 2019. New factories come online daily, and upgrades enhance productivity in existing factories. China's factory output, which now includes electric vehicles, lithium batteries, and renewable energy equipment, is larger than that of the U.S., Germany, Japan, South Korea, and the U.K. combined. Now, as President Trump wages a trade war with Beijing, China won't be able to easily access its biggest and most reliable foreign market, which means that some $400 billion in cheap goods must be rerouted to other countries. The real fireworks have yet to begin, said Michael Pettis, a professor of finance at Peking University. Has this happened before? The World Trade Organization officially welcomed China, already the world's sixth largest economy, into its fold in 2001. Then President Bill Clinton was enthusiastic. He believed China's membership would benefit the U.S. economically, while also promoting democratization in China. But rather than usher in political reforms, China's rise to a global trading behemoth solidified the Chinese Communist Party's power. In the U.S., meanwhile, there were winners and losers. Consumer prices fell and service sector jobs increased, but the influx of cheap Chinese products has put a significant dent in U.S. manufacturing. Though trade pressure leveled out by 2011, the hardest-hit industries and areas, like the American South, never recovered from declines in wages. Studies on the China shock from economists David H. Alter, David Dorn, and Gordon H. Hansen found that trade with China accounted for 1 million manufacturing job losses between 2001 and 2011, and 2.4 million job losses overall. We didn't see people picking up and moving to better opportunities, as in historical narratives of U.S. resiliency, Alter said. Which countries will be affected? The tsunami is coming for everyone, said Katherine Tai, the U.S. trade representative under former President Joe Biden. The fears of a second worldwide China shock predate Trump's tariffs, and the pace of the sequel may be even more rapid than the original shock that hit the U.S. at the turn of the century. Layoffs are already underway in Indonesia's textile and apparel industry, which saw roughly 250,000 job losses over the past 2 years, with another 500,000 cuts likely to follow. Other emerging economies like Brazil and India have to compete with China and sell internet cables and electronics. And China's rapid rise in the car and green technology industries, China's BYD is now the world's biggest maker of electric vehicles, poses a threat to Germany. How are those countries preparing? Most are implementing at least some safeguards. Brazil now has a 35% tariff on Chinese fiber optic cables, while Chinese textile imports face a 200% tariff in Indonesia. Mexico is reviewing its tariffs on China, and India has launched a probe into the dumping of Chinese goods, from solar cells to aluminum foil. Thailand and Malaysia have slapped sales taxes on lower-priced imported goods. The situation presents a conundrum for developing countries, though, since China, seeking to exert its geopolitical influence, often invests heavily in their infrastructure. Blocking imports, therefore, isn't easy. Do you really want to complain over shoes when someone's building you a port? Asked Deborah Elms, the head of trade policy at the Asia-based Henrich Foundation, a research firm. Could China's domestic market be an outlet? While there have been some signs this year that Chinese consumer spending could be on the upswing, domestic demand still isn't strong enough for the overflow of goods produced. Consumption accounts for only 53% of China's GDP, well below the global average of 72%. Previously, there weren't many signs that the government was interested in redirecting its investments from manufacturing industries to boost consumer spending, but Beijing is starting to turn its attention to people's wallets. The government has announced stimulus plans with consumer loans and vehicle trade-in payments, among other enticements. Now, in light of Trump's tariffs, economists are urging the CCP to do even more, but there may not be a quick-fix policy solution. Will tariffs really shield the U.S.? Trump waged his trade war based on America's trade deficit with China, but bilateral trade data aren't always the best indicators of the overall trade relationship between two countries. In the past, China has skirted U.S. tariffs by offshoring manufacturing to countries like Vietnam. Even before the current trade wars, Chinese manufacturers had already been moving operations offshore, with Chinese automakers opening or planning plants in Hungary, Turkey, and Thailand. Chinese manufacturers see the factories as insurance against U.S. trade barriers and also a way to build local goodwill. Those factories, which often rely on parts made in China, provide a way for China's industries to ship goods to the U.S. at lower tariff rates. There may be little anyone can do to reduce China's hold on the global market, except for China itself, and that will require a major transformation of domestic economic policy that will focus less on increasing output and more on increasing domestic demand. Time for a few of the best columns. First up, Trump's peace plan is dead. President Trump's vow to bring peace to Ukraine seems all but dead and forgotten, said Kathy Young. Late last month, Trump was touting an apparent success, an agreement for a partial ceasefire. But Putin agreed only to limited terms that were likely to benefit Moscow more than Kyiv, such as ending the destruction of Russia's oil depots and the use of force in the Black Sea, where Ukraine has already taken out a third of Russia's warships. Trump has issued only tepid objections as Russia escalated its attacks on residential neighborhoods, such as a recent missile strike on a playground that killed 9 children. The White House says peace efforts continue, but confirmed Ukraine wouldn't even be discussed at U.S.-Russia talks that started last week in Istanbul. The bottom line is that Putin has no interest in ending the war. Indeed, he's given every indication he plans to escalate, falsely claiming Russia is nearing victory while calling Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky illegitimate. Given Trump's appalling deference to the Russian strongman, the war will almost certainly continue into 2026. We may see Trump quietly drop his faux peace efforts once its futility becomes undeniable. Reviving a nuclear deal with Iran. In his first term, President Trump, for no good reason, blew up the successful agreement the U.S. and its allies had negotiated with Iran, said Joe Cirincione. Now he's trying to bring it back in much the same form. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, negotiated by the Obama administration, had successfully blocked all of Iran's paths to a bomb with an intrusive inspection and monitoring regime. In 2018, Trump withdrew the U.S. from the deal as part of his efforts to erase anything Barack Obama had achieved. Trump claimed at the time he would force Iran to accept a bigger, better deal that would include ending its regional aggression. But it didn't happen. Instead, Iran went to work enriching a stockpile of uranium that could be converted into 6 or 7 nuclear bombs in just a few weeks. To gain leverage, Trump is threatening to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities, but that would trigger a regional war, likely crippling world oil shipments through the Persian Gulf. Now Trump is signaling he'd be happy with an Iran deal light, focusing only on Iran's uranium enrichment. Republican Iran hawks would be dissatisfied, but with so much going wrong, Trump needs a real win. This column's from Lebanon. Israel can't bomb its way to acceptance. The unthinkable has become thinkable, said Fifi Abu Dib. In Lebanon, people are suddenly talking about normalizing relations with Israel, a country we have refused to recognize since its 1948 creation, and with which we have been in a state of on-again, off-again conflict for 60 years. With Hezbollah weakened by Israeli bombing and a more pro-Western government in Beirut, the U.S. is pushing for a deal. In an ideal world, of course, we would want relations with our neighbor, but this isn't that world. For a treaty to be honest and lasting, it has to be balanced, and there's nothing equal about our relationship with Israel. It not only continues to bomb Beirut neighborhoods on the pretext of targeting Hezbollah, but also insists on occupying 5 strategic points inside our southern territory. And while a key condition of normalization has always been the establishment of a Palestinian state, that cause now seems lost. Israel is bent on driving back Palestinians with unprecedented violence in both Gaza and the West Bank, and all with the blessing of the United States. Lebanon's government is outraged but utterly helpless. We have nothing to negotiate with, and now a deeply unjust deal may be forced upon us. The scales are tipping, and not in our favor. The last word, our feature article, takes us away from politics for the moment. Building a 1,000-year-old tree. Gnarled ancient trunks are an essential and magical part of old forest habitat, said Matthew Ponsford in Noema magazine. Now, arborists are recreating their properties in younger trees. Even in early summer, when Sherwood Forest is thick with lime-colored new leaves, you start to see it from a few hundred paces away. Its trunk is 36 feet around, and its canopy stretches for almost 3 bus lengths. Its broad, bowl-shaped crown is propped up by a ring of metal columns like walking sticks measured to fit each of its groaning boughs. The major oak, as it's called, is surrounded by a fence that keeps its many visitors from tramping too close. On a summer day, I visited. Reg Harris, a 50-something arborist in thick utility trousers and a sun-bleached polo, invited me to hop over and stand for a while at the foot of the giant tree. The major, Harris told me, sprouted from an acorn here at least 8 centuries ago. No one knows exactly when. Some estimate it has seen the arrival of 1,000 summers. It's shorter than it once was, Harris said. The tree would have reached its peak height sometime around Christopher Columbus' arrival in the Americas, but its upper limbs have long since dropped off. In its later years, it has developed a fat, furrowed trunk that is twisted and fissured through storms and grown boulder-sized calluses, which bulge where wounds were torn and healed lifetimes ago. Place a hand on against its lichen-crusted bark, and its hard flesh feels as cool and sturdy as a cathedral's timbers. Up close, it's possible to see signs of rot and inhabitation between the band-aids Harris' predecessors have placed to try to keep the tree alive. The walking sticks, which replaced a system of iron chains, some of them are still stuck fast in the limbs, protect the tree's trunk from being torn apart by the cantilevered weight of its branches. A macabre process of cannibalization began centuries ago, during which time the tree has basically consumed its own rotting pulpy core, creating a 10-foot-high cavern in the trunk. Harris is one of the few people alive to have been in there, where bugs crawl and beefsteak fungus erupts. Harris introduced me to the major not to show me a withering geriatric, but rather a sort of living blueprint. It's a template or inspiration, he said, that's guiding a set of experimental techniques and technologies that aim to recreate some of the major's rich collection of scars and wrinkles, hollows and decay. These veteran features of the rarest, oldest trees are what brought me to Sherwood in search of an answer to an impossible challenge that Harris and other expert ARBs are collectively facing, to artificially recreate in a fraction of time the things that only the slow movement of eons is known to make. Britain's oaks are both symbols of national pride and vital infrastructure in its forest. Collectively, the country's oaks support about 2,300 species of mammals, birds, invertebrates, mosses, fungi, and lichens. Many of them, like the family of bats that live high in the major's shattered trunk, find shelter only in old trees and feast on the deadwood-loving creatures that crawl the dark bark canyons and damp cavities that the tree builds up over countless human lifetimes. On their branches and trunks, squirrels make their drays, dens, and woodpeckers their nest. So-called secondary cavity nesters, including the petite pied flycatcher and the stocky foot-tall tawny owl, later take over the vacated hollows that the woodpeckers excavated. Taken altogether, trees like the major are complex mountains of microhabitats. Unfortunately, they are roughly one in a million. The UK has an estimated 170 million oaks, but only 115 ancient giants the size of the major were found in a census by the University of Oxford. In total, Sherwood Forest has about 380 trees older than 400 years, usually the minimum age to have developed veteran features, and be classified by arborists as an ancient. The rest of the continent combined has fewer ancients than the UK. Partly this is a consequence of the UK's long history of ring-fencing vast areas away from the common folk as private reserves for kings and queens. Sherwood Forest has been recognized as a protected area since it became William the Conqueror's hunting ground in the 11th century. Still, thousands of its trees have been hauled away over the centuries, destined to be used to build ships during the Napoleonic Wars, or cathedrals like St. Paul's in London, or else cut down in some other wave of logging. The handful that survived, like the major, were usually spared the axe because they were considered too old, gnarled, or rotten to be of use. On the day I visited, a haze of tree pollen hung overhead as the forest began its most active season of growth and reproduction. But what Harris wanted to show me was rot and decay. "That one died," he said, enthusiastically pointing to an oak that still had a forking silhouette of branches but was entirely without leaves, "and yet it's absolutely full of life." Deeper in the backwoods, Harris pointed out dead branches hanging from still-living joints, places beloved by a moth that lives behind the bark. He stopped to explain ram's horn callusing, a wave-like shape of wound wood where the tree scabs around injuries, a favorite sleeping spot for bats. There were split trunks where the core of the tree had been suddenly exposed by a storm or lightning strike, and walking trees where a tree cracked or was blown down and rerooted itself a few feet away. All of it is habitat for something, even if it's microscopic fungi, invisible to the naked human eye. An hour into our walk, by then deep in Sherwood, Harris found an unremarkable oak he'd been hoping to show me. About 3 feet up its trunk, there was an unnaturally rectangular hole that looked like an upright mailbox. An inch or two of wound wood curled around the edges. Harris grinned with pride. Squeezing his hand into the slit, he turned over a leaf that had fallen inside and found two wood lice rummaging through a dusting of decaying tree soil. 2 years ago, he'd found a darkling beetle here, one of the wood mold specialists that are fond of hanging around deadwood chimneys. Without help, a tree like this, a very uninteresting, very boring, very small tree, maybe 25 to 30 years old, would not form a dank, bug-crawling crevice for perhaps a few hundred years. So, to defeat time, arbs like Harris have put the tools of tree maintenance to work on surgical tree wounding. Sherwood is now the site of the UK's largest program of veteranization, as the process is known to arborists. The goal of veteranization, which is only ever done to young trees, is not to kill them, but to leave them living with features like storm damage or damp hollows that would usually not form until much later in life. Armed with a chainsaw, an arborist might make a slice akin to a lightning strike, carve out an artificial woodpecker hole, or make a series of plunging cuts into a trunk to create a nesting box. Walloping the base of the tree with a sledgehammer has turned out to be a surprisingly efficient way to cause a column of rot to form above. This horse kick damage replicates impacts by roaming herds of horses in extinct megafauna, like aurochs or elks, whose creative disturbances have been disappearing or missing entirely from the British Isles for millennia. Thanks to its unique stock of ancient trees, Sherwood is one of the best places in Europe to find deadwood-loving invertebrates like the red-robed cardinal click beetle and wood-boring anabid beetles, whose backs look like they are carved out of wood. Known as saprozoic invertebrates, these species recycle many of the forest resources, providing an important food source for birds and mammals, and carry tiny organisms around the forest that are important for its overall health, like mites and bacteria. Damp little caverns within old trees are living miniature worlds where saprozoic invertebrates find food, shelter, mates, and more. Over time, the cavity naturally expands, so it is used by a succession of species with increasing body size, all the way up to bears in places like Canada. Matthew Wainhouse, a mycologist who works on forest ecology, told me, in 1970, the poet W.S. Merwin published a four-page instructional manual for putting a tree that had been felled back together. The first step is to stick each leaf back to its twig, he wrote, then attach the bark and branches that had come loose. Unchopping a tree is a fable written in meticulous, matter-of-fact steps. It goes without saying that if the tree was hollow in whole or in part, and contained old nests of bird or mammal insects, or hordes of nuts such structures as wasps or bees build for their survival, the contents would have to be repaired where necessary, and reassembled, insofar as possible, in their original order, including the shells of nuts already opened. With spiders' webs, you must simply do the best you can. In a tense final act, the reader is commanded to remove the supporting scaffold of chains and struts that prop up the rebuilt tree until it is left standing at last on its own. It is as though its weight for a moment stood on your heart. You listen for a thud of settlement, a warning creak deep in the intricate joinery. You cannot believe it will hold. How like something dreamed it is, standing there, all by itself. I had this image in mind as I walked through Sherwood, studying the major, propped up on metal sticks, and the various trees bearing band-aids from preservation or tool marks from veteranization. It's hard not to feel that conservation and restoration often turn wilderness into artifacts like Merwin's tree, no longer their wild selves, but artificially remade. During my research on veteranization, I read about researchers attempting to restore a temperate rainforest in Scotland by painstakingly sticking moss and lichen back onto old trees. And Wayne House told me about a Douglas fir forest in Oregon where fungi were administered somewhat less delicately with a 12-gauge shotgun. But I was reminded by Harris that artificial interventions are just the latest chapter in the age-old human management of trees and forest. There's much more to Sherwood's story than the ancient royal decree that the commoners should be kept out. For generation upon generation, people have been active among the trees of the forest, harvesting branches for firewood, grazing livestock, and drilling into trunks to assess timber. Even before the Norman conquest in 1066, virtually all woodland in England had already been highly modified by human action. Across the planet, forests are hybrid places, not perfectly protected away from human impact or wholly manufactured piece by piece, but intertwined to one degree or another in our lives. Those who know the major say it teaches a lesson in humility. Human management of something as complex as an old tree, let alone a whole forest, is a chastening ordeal. The oak's own ingenuity constantly surprises arborists and forest biologists. With our current technology, at least, humans could never hope to build an artificial 1,000-year-old tree. All we can do is provide something in a younger tree that might simulate some of those properties, Wayne House told me, just to give enough time and space for some of these things to have a future. Merwin came to a similar conclusion. For 50 years after he published Unchopping a Tree, he labored to reforest 3 acres of agricultural scrubland on the Hawaiian island of Maui. He carted seaweed from coastal coves to spread on the barren land, heaved wheelbarrows of manures from neighbors' cows and goats, and planted some 14,000 native and imported palms. Many of them died, and the resulting collection of trees was not much like a Hawaiian forest. Only a forest knows how to grow a forest, he eventually concluded. Amid the unfolding and intertwined ecological crises, we are chasing eons we do not have. Several people I interviewed for this story mentioned their own deaths as moments in the overall arc of the work they were doing, signifying that it will be decades before success or failure has become clear. What alternative is there but to keep going? There's hope, Harris said as he looked into the cavity in the unremarkable young oak, observing the wood, lice, and a teaspoon or so of tree soil. I think that's what I take from this. There is actual hope. This was adapted from a story that originally appeared in Noema magazine. Here's one of the business columns. Decoupling, the U.S.-China trade divorce. A bridal store owner in Pennsylvania is slashing his salary to cover increased cost on dress orders. A kitchen equipment importer is planning layoffs. And a cosmetic bag maker in Virginia thinks China tariffs may be the final blow, said Jason Douglas in the Wall Street Journal. Businesses all across the country are having to adjust to a reality of higher tariffs as the trade war with China intensifies. When President Trump announced a tariff pause for dozens of countries last week, Wall Street breathed a sigh of relief. But Main Street is suffering as trading between the two superpowers, America and China, grinds to a halt. Despite times of animosity, the two economies are deeply intertwined. Unwinding that relationship will present profound changes for American consumers and businesses that have depended on access to cheap Chinese production. The pain will not be one-sided. China has based its entire economic model around producing goods to export to the world's biggest consumer market. The temporary exclusion of smartphones, laptops, and other consumer electronics from tariffs will help, said Sam Joyner in the Financial Times, but the impact will still be widespread. More than three-quarters of the video game consoles, food processors, and electric fans imported into the U.S. were made in China, as well as 75% of the dolls, tricycles, scooters, and other wheeled toys delivered to American customers. Moving manufacturing elsewhere will not be easy. Consider the example of Apple. It has been trying to reorient its supply lines for years, leaning heavily on India. Still, if Apple were to reserve its entire iPhone output from India for the U.S. market, it would cover only about half of the necessary supply. There are still plenty of people on Main Street cheering on Trump's policy, said Sohrab Ahmari in Unheard. That is especially true for the regional manufacturers who form the heart of the GOP's power base. The manufacturing-heavy counties that have lost jobs and seen their living standards decline can trace a direct line between America deindustrialization and the inclusion of China in the World Trade Organization in 2001. A trade war, however, hurts other groups that Trump supports, including farmers like me, said Caleb Ragland in the Free Press. The standoff with China has me worried about who will buy my crops. The U.S. is the world's leader in soybean production, and China is by far our biggest customer. But the longer this stalemate continues, the likelier China is to take its business elsewhere. Get used to the idea of a bifurcated global economy, said The Economist. Trump appears set on decoupling from China to contain its economic rise, whatever happens to the balance of trade. Commercial relations between the two countries have reached a contentious low point, but they have also been in secular decline. The trade war has arrived with speed and ferocity China did not anticipate. One survival strategy is to sell parts and components to trading partners like Thailand and Vietnam, where they can be incorporated into finished products for export to America. But Trump knows this strategy well and has warned against it. Make no mistake, the death knell of the post-war trading order has begun. Here's a technology article. Climate tech. Can geoengineering cool the globe? Some scientists think we can quickly cool the planet, said Carol Gramling in Science News, by blocking the sun. Solar geoengineering is an umbrella term for a variety of possible strategies to reflect sunlight. They include injecting reflective molecules into the stratosphere or brightening clouds over the ocean. In essence, the strategy is to mimic what happens when a volcano erupts and sulfur and ash are spewed into the atmosphere, lowering Earth's temperature. But there's also a great deal of wariness about bringing the ideas out of the lab. In 2024, Harvard University shuttered its solar geoengineering research program after the test flight of one of its cloud-seeding balloons in Sweden was blocked by protests from an indigenous group. In the U.S., 16 states have introduced bills to ban solar geoengineering, in some cases because of a debunked conspiracy theory that the government is already conducting weather modification via chemtrails sprayed by airplanes. Bizarre as the chemtrail claims may be, public skepticism isn't surprising, said Rebecca White in Science. Climate engineering is perhaps more unsettling to the public than genetic engineering because it involves tinkering with complex natural systems, which largely renders it irreversible. The main problem with geoengineering, said Raymond Pierre Humbert and Michael Mann in The Guardian, is that it treats the symptoms of climate change, but unless we change our carbon-emitting behavior, leaves the underlying malignancy to keep growing. That becomes a problem if we ever stop seeding the atmosphere. We'll be left with a catastrophic termination shock. Most geoengineering research today is led by scientists at universities and federal agencies, said Ramin Skiba in Wired. But that is starting to change as more venture capital flows into climate tech strategies. One Israeli geoengineering startup called Stardust has raised $15 million for the development of a proprietary aerosol particle to be distributed about 60,000 feet into the atmosphere through a machine mounted on an aircraft. The idea is thus far being tested only indoors, and little is known about the particles other than that they are non-sulfate. Still, the prospect of proprietary, privately held geoengineering technologies worries some experts who have questioned Stardust's lack of transparency, likening it to a defense contractor for climate alteration. Such worries are reasonable, yet the question remains, said David King in The Guardian. If not now, when? We need drastic and immediate climate action. Some of the necessary levers to regain control are uncomfortable, even controversial. Ideas such as brightening marine clouds to reflect sunlight may have once seemed extreme. But we do not have the luxury of rejecting solutions outright before we have thoroughly investigated their risks, trade-offs, and feasibility. One of the Talking Points articles. RFK Jr., a public health wrecking ball. During his confirmation hearings, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. presented himself as a supporter of vaccines, said Apoorva Mandavili in the New York Times. But his actions as health secretary tell a starkly different story. He and his agencies have taken far-reaching, sometimes subtle steps to undermine confidence in vaccine efficacy and safety. Last week, the health secretary announced a massive study that he says will determine by September the cause of the autism epidemic, led by a top proponent of the repeatedly debunked theory that vaccines cause autism. Under RFK Jr.'s conspiracy-minded anti-scientific leadership, health agencies have halted research into vaccine hesitancy, cut billions in state funding for childhood immunization, and terminated an ad campaign promoting flu shots. Top FDA vaccine regulator Peter Marks quit last month under pressure, saying it was clear Kennedy was not after truth, but subservient confirmation of his misinformation and lies. Even amid a Texas measles outbreak that has sickened more than 500 people and killed two children, Kennedy has failed to offer a firm, unambiguous endorsement of vaccination, said Jonathan Cohn in The Bulwark. He begrudgingly told an interviewer last week that the federal government's position is that people should get the measles vaccine. But he quickly undercut his tepid endorsement by falsely saying that vaccines aren't safety tested. Last week, Kennedy had the astounding chutzpah to attend the funeral of an unvaccinated 8-year-old Texas girl who died of measles, said Robin Abkarian in the Los Angeles Times. Her death is the direct result of years of vaccine skepticism and hostility sown by Kennedy and his anti-science allies. The erosion of trust in vaccines just scratches the surface of the damage Kennedy is doing, said Adam Cankren in Politico. In 2 months, he has dramatically reshaped the U.S. health apparatus, firing 10,000 government health officials and scientists, erasing a vast trove of collective expertise and institutional knowledge, and leaving his department in an unprecedented state of upheaval. The public health infrastructure he's dismantling is the greatest invention of the industrial age, said Troy Farah in Salon. We now take for granted its success in reducing childhood mortality, eradicating horrific diseases like smallpox and polio, and giving us longer, healthier lives. If we let Kennedy's reckless stupidity reverse a century of progress, the impact will be felt for generations. And a few of the short notes. Researchers using cadavers to study the accumulation of microplastics found on average 7 grams of plastic per brain, about the amount in 5 water bottle caps. Brain samples from 2024 had nearly 50% more microplastics than samples from 2016. Federal spending has gone up even as DOGE slashes jobs and contracts. The government has spent $154 billion more since the inauguration than President Biden's administration spent over the same period, in part due to higher Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid payments and higher costs to service debt. The Department of the Navy has culled 381 books from the Naval Academy Library, including works covering the Holocaust, feminism, civil rights, and racism. Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings and Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility were removed. The Bell Curve, which argues that intelligence is linked to race, was not. On the poll watch, 58% of Americans oppose President Trump's tariffs on imported goods, while 42% approve. 65% think the tariffs will make the economy worse in the short term, while 34% think it will make it better in the long term. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from Maya Angelou, quoted in the Bulwark. She says, "We may encounter many defeats, but we must never be defeated." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.